I'd like to call to order the Ad Hoc Consultant Selection Subcommittee, Request for Proposals of Professional Services for the Beltline Trail, March 9th, 2021, 4 o'clock p.m. Item number two, Notification of Open Meetings Act posted on the back wall. I can read it. A copy of the Open Meetings Act, Nebraska Revised Statute 84-1407 through 84-1414 is posted on the back wall of the meeting room. Prior to turning to the agenda for today's meeting, I would like to announce the procedure that will be used for this meeting. With respect to each agenda item, the directors will first hear staff proposals and recommendations. Then the public will be given the opportunity to speak to the item. Lastly, the directors will discuss the item and take action, and we ask that the public not interrupt the director's discussion and action. Thank you. We're going to substitute Larry Bradley. I don't think Tim Fowler is going to be here for this meeting. A quorum call.
Begley.
Here.
McCormick. Thompson.
Here.
Bradley. And Chair.
Here. Item number four, adoption of agenda.
Second.
Motion and a second. Roll call.
Second. Begley.
Aye.
McCormick.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
Bradley.
Yes.
And Chair.
Yes. Item number five, proof of publication of meeting notice. I have that. Become part of the permanent record. Item number six, review and recommendation of professional services contract with Earhart Griffin and Associates for the Beltline Trail Project. Eric Williams.
Yep, thank you. Bill, if you can pull up the map, it's about page 8 of the PDF. There you go, and zoom out just a little bit, one page back. The Beltline Trail is on the former railroad corridor from approximately Military and Hamilton. I'm sorry, one page back, please. There we go. From approximately Military and Hamilton at the lower left corner, stretching to the northeast, past Adams Park, and continuing up to about 31st and Sprague Street, where it meets the Transit Center. This map shows the proposed corridor, the location of the trail. It's divided roughly into a southern portion at the bottom of the page. Bill, if you could show that portion first. Sorry. A little further. There we go. The southern portion down here in the very lower left. There is a break around the area of 40th and Lake due to the nature of the land use in that location. And then the corridor picks up again at Maple Street and continues further to the northeast. That's generally referred to as the north section of the trail. From the interviews, staff has negotiated with Earhart Griffin and their team to develop a scope and fee for the for this project. In general, this outlines the design services necessary to take the entire corridor to 60% plans, so that we have sufficient information to identify the land rights that are necessary along the entire corridor. And then there are two primary or priority locations that we anticipate will be easier to construct and we want to advance more quickly. The first is all the way at the next page, please, Bill. The first is on the west side of Adams Park. King Elementary is just to the west. The kind of sloping piece is the old rail corridor. And then it connects over to an existing parking lot. This area is one parcel owned by the land bank and then land owned by the city of Omaha. We do not expect any significant challenges. The design here should be relatively straightforward. And in order to advance the project from a planning and design phase into construction in early 2022, we want to prioritize the survey here and designs here not just to 60%, but all the way to full construction plans out for bid. And again, anticipating construction in spring of 2022. EGA has indicated that that timeline is very achievable. We should be able to bid in the fall where we get competitive prices, be able to do off-season work in the winter. We expect some tree clearing is necessary. Be in construction early in the spring of 2022 in this location. And next page. A second location at the very northeast end of the trail. This is where Paxton Boulevard, the kind of sloping road or curvy road to the west, meets into this abnormal dual Y-shaped intersection. The expected connection here is the eastern portion from Sprague Street along the east side of what's called 31st Street in that location up to the Transit Center, which is the building that looks like a lacrosse stick. That section is entirely in city right-of-way, and it will connect the, by this time, what will be the existing North Omaha Trail down to the existing in need of repair section of John A. Creighton Boulevard Trail that is anticipated to be eventually replaced and upgraded by the Beltline Trail through that location. So these two pieces are identified as priorities for survey right away, and then moving not just to 60% plans, but 100% plans, anticipating bidding in the fall, and then construction in the spring of 2022. That summarizes generally the anticipated scope for the project. Again, the timeline is to have these two priority sections by the fall. That's reflected in the Gantt chart, and there's a section there that shows construction is the long bar at the end. That's the last page of your attachments. The total cost is expected to be $282,155. Again, this covers the project management, survey, design work, bidding, and construction management services for the two priority areas. We anticipate the other areas will move forward to final design and eventually construction at a later date, but there is more uncertainty in the property rights and the design aspects in those other locations, so they are not currently included in this contract. This contract structure is based largely on the 60% plans contract structure that we have used for the priority watershed projects in the past, which anticipates the potential for an amendment to do additional design services in the future. But this is the work that we know we can accomplish now and that we'd like to move forward so that we can have projects completed early next year. Dan Dolezal from EGA is our prime contact, and he's available to answer any questions you might have. The recommendation is to approve this contract, get this finalized with EGA, and we would begin the design work immediately.
Thank you. Can we have a motion on this item?
I move we go with staff recommendation.
I'll second.
Second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? I don't see any. Directors? Director Thompson?
The handout here, it looks like the trail has been realigned from the original proposal, like Malcolm X isn't part of it now?
Correct. And I had mentioned that previously. The RFP map did include the rail corridor section from the north side of Adams Park on Bedford.
Through that green space, Brett.
Correct, up to Evans. That is a privately owned parcel. We had notified the property owners that we were moving forward with the design services on this project, and they requested that their land not be included in the trail at this time. It is possible they would request to be included at a future time, but we do not anticipate construction in that location because the adjacent community use is moving in a different direction. This red route has been identified as kind of an alternate expected route. It continues along the edge of the park and picks up at John A. Creighton Boulevard. Again, we will continue discussion with the community organization in that location, but they have requested that they not be included in the potential construction. And as private property, we don't expect to move forward with the project if they are not willing.
Which means the part about Sprague, if we build that, obviously we're never going to go negotiate with that landowner?
If we move forward with the construction on the north side of Adams Park and then on John A. Creighton on the east side there of the map, I do not anticipate that we would recommend returning and doing additional construction between the north side of the park and then two major streets up along the corridor that is owned by Malcolm X. No, the trail location would move essentially to the north side of the park and along the boulevard rather than on the former rail corridor.
I mean further up by Sprague, that other green space where Paxson Boulevard comes down.
So the one more page, I'm sorry, two pages down, please, Bill. Here we go. This is the part by Sprague up to the transit center. This is the very northern part. It is kind of off the north end of the map. It's a little difficult to see, but it's, from Sprague up to the transit center is the very, very northernmost or uppermost portion.
The original plan was going to include that anyway?
It was. This was clarified the day after the RFP was posted because the North Omaha Trail, on which we are a cost share partner, refined their scope and decided that their terminus would be on 31st and Sprague. And so our project is now extending along the east side of 31st Street to connect to the transit center. One of the two projects was anticipated to make that last about 700 feet connection, and we agreed with the City of Omaha and the North Omaha Trail team that this would be the more efficient way to get it completed.
Okay. Any other questions? Roll call.
McCormick.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
Bradley.
Yes.
Begley.
Aye.
And Chair.
Aye. I think that completes this. I'll head to PPO. Program Projects and Operations Subcommittee meeting, March 9th, 2021. I've already talked about the Notification of Open Meetings Act, still the same. Item number three, quorum call.
Here.
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 Ed Shepherdson. Aye, here. Item number four, adoption of agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Motion and a second. Roll call.
Wyatt?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
Binsky?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yeah.
Yes.
And Shepherdson.
Aye. Yeah, but Bennett is the alternate. I don't think Fowler's here, so he'd be the alternate. Item number five, proof of publication of meeting notice. I have proof of publication of tonight's meeting. That'll become part of the permanent record. Item number six, review and recommendation of Elkhorn River Improvement Project Area, IPA, operation and maintenance assessment. Eric Williams.
This is the annual assessment for the benefited parcels along the Elkhorn River IPA area. We filed this documentation with Douglas County. It then asks the county to assess a total of $20,000. To the parcels along that stretch of the river. That money is then turned into the district. We hold it in an account and use it for emergency repairs. As indicated, after the March of 2019 flood, we did carry out emergency repairs totaling $983,337, and 75% reimbursement from FEMA is still anticipated. The work is done. The documentation is submitted. The reimbursement has not been delivered yet. So essentially, that work used up all of the balance of the IPA budget that had been collected over the last several years. Current balance is $1,052, so the $20,000 assessment will be added to that balance. This essentially represents that the IPA functioned exactly as designed. We saved money for the time when work was necessary. We completed the work successfully, and now we're going to collect money again in the event that additional work would be necessary in the future. So the recommendation is to approve the resolution so that we can submit the documents to Douglas County, and the assessment for 2021 will be carried out.
Thank you.
Also move staff recommendation, but you have a question.
Okay, no. Second. Okay. Rich Teaser?
You've already identified a few areas. I think I pointed out some to you that probably need some treatment. Is that how many sites have you located that might need some treatment this coming year?
We did look at, with the drone inspection, we looked at the bank that you indicated. It seems like it's probably stable and doesn't need immediate repair work, but it is a location we expect to keep an eye on for the future.
Okay.
The appearance of the rock seems to be active but stable. So we don't have any expected work this year. Generally, we go out in the spring, usually after the snow is gone and before leaf out. And so we will probably be out over the next couple weeks to inspect and see if there is any other changes that have occurred. That would be a difficult condition now because the balance of the account has been depleted, and so it would be challenging to conduct work right now. We did a significant amount of work at those five locations last year, so we will inspect those. We should be able to get a pretty good look with just on the ground and then also with the drone inspection. We don't anticipate any work this year. The idea is that we generally do not carry out work. We do an inspection, but we don't have any planned this year.
Since you treated worked really pretty good in doing what it's supposed to be doing as far as falling in.
And that was that extra high-density rock because the other limestone wasn't available, so they should be in very stable shape for a long time.
Okay. Thank you.
Jeff?
Do you ever get any feedback from the landowners themselves about these fees and projects and so forth?
No. We occasionally see people when we're on site doing inspections or during some of the construction work. They are generally appreciative. They recognize that this is a collected effort to stabilize the entire reach of the river to avoid major shifts, which could occur if there was a cutoff or something like that. So generally, people have been appreciative when we've seen them. We don't receive comments to the office that I know of, and no one complains or anything like that. They understand the purpose, and they see the benefit because we've done really good work over the last couple of years.
Thank you.
I think the biggest thing I've heard is they're wanting to know why we're not going further upstream, you know, on Highway 30, above Highway 30 there.
Yeah, there is one landowner on the right bank or the west side directly upstream from the highway bridge.
Yeah.
We have referred them to NDOT a couple times. It seems like debris accumulation on the bridge might be part of the problem, but they are outside of the range. They are not assessed. So they are not paying into the IPA, so that is out of the range of work that could be conducted with money in this account.
I think that's Faye Patterson's property, isn't it?
I think so. I think I've talked to him two or three times, and it's unfortunate. I mean, the IPA funds are for the area that is impacted, but we've conveyed that to them.
I forgot to ask, anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Director Burnett.
The assessment would start today, correct?
I think it starts on Thursday.
The 11th?
Yes, Thursday.
And then interest starts on the 11th as well. Grace period ends just a month later. That seems accelerated to me. Why is that? What's the rush?
This is the same time frame we use every year, so there is not interest accumulated until April 30th. Mm-hmm. And so this gives plenty of people to pay the assessed amounts, and this is the same format that we've used as long as I've been here. I think it's a standard kind of duration that assessments like this use for Douglas County.
So every year we do this?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. And all we do is just change the dates, but the time frame remains the same. It is not accelerated any more than it has been in the past.
I think the way it works is the 11th is when the interest starts running, but they don't accrue or charge any interest until it's 50 days.
Yeah.
But they charge it back to the 11th.
Only if you have not. And we have generally not had a problem with that. Douglas County does the collection, and then they turn the funds over to us.
Is that a county rule, or why would we start charging interest the day that we assess the levy?
So the resolution itself and the document that specifies all of the terms that are attached there, those are provided by the county. Again, I'm unclear of the history of the duration of the interest period. Perhaps Marlon could answer that. It was here, and this was the format when I started in 2014, and it's been the same duration each year since then.
You're right. They're pretty well established by the county and what they normally do.
Thank you.
Okay.
The landowners are really very enthusiastic about this. We're seeing a lot of their property, and the property is pretty valuable out there, so I don't hear any complaints on it up and down that river where we have the project.
And the benefit of the FEMA funding in 2019, we were able to leverage 75% more money for investing in stabilization based on the money that was available because it was an emergency declaration in that location. So it was a very, very good deal for us and for the benefited properties.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Jeff?
Yes.
Zabinski?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
Thomas?
Item number 7, review and recommendation of amendments to the professional services contract with Olson, Inc. for the design of Cramper Lake / Hubbard and Fitler Creek Water Main Extension Project. Justin Novak.
Good evening, Directors. Justin Novak, Project Manager. Back in August of 2020, you guys approved an amended contract with Olson's for the water main extension in Dakota County for the Hubbard Lake and the Fiddler Creek project for $353,589. Since then, you know, with this project, kind of give you a quick background. The USDA is basically going to be our grant as well as our funding source for the loan. So there's a lot of regulations you have to abide by when you're working through the feds with this kind of program. So in September 29th, 2020, we received a letter from the Pawnee Nation about doing a cultural resources inspection, basically, you know, looking for anything that may have to do with Indian artifacts. That way our project was not to interfere with any of those things. That fell under the discretion of the management for the 10%. So that was approved by John Winkler at the time. Since then, the USDA has gotten a new engineer on staff. The guy that originally approved our plan, Marty, has left. The new guy that came on staff reviewed our plan, everything that we had submitted before, and sent us a page and a half of additional information that is required for the USDA loan. So there's another contract amendment from Olson's on February 19th, 2021 for $14,000 that basically will address all the additional concerns that the USDA has. So that has put us over the 10% allotment, which is why I'm here tonight to get board approval for increasing our new contract amount to $397,000 or $397,589. So that's kind of the short gist of it. Any questions?
Thanks, Justin. We can have a motion on this item.
Awesome. I would move a staff recommendation.
Okay. Second.
Second. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director Bradley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You sure the Pawnee Nation or Ponca Nation?
It was the Pawnee, I believe. Let's see, I can tell you, I got it right here. That was the Pawnee Nation.
Okay.
Yep. No, it was Pawnee. Yep. It
was Cramper Lake.
Yep. No, they sent us an actual form letter back then requesting that we do the cultural resources inspection. So, of course, we obliged with that. And unfortunately, it fell under the 10%. So we were able just to kind of move forward and get that going. Now with this second revision per the USDA, it put us over that 10% allotment, so here we are tonight. So it is a little bit confusing that we've kind of already approved an amendment, but that was under, you know, the director, the policy 15-2. So now that we've got this additional money for $14,000, it puts us over that 10%. So here I am tonight.
I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. No, not a problem.
Justin, but what I was getting at was the Nebraska Historical Society, did they do any? Because it seemed to me also at the, you know, whether or not we had a federal loan, that there, before that project was even built, I'm quite sure there was an extensive go-over, if there was any Native American artifacts or remains or anything of that nature.
Yeah, so anytime we do any kind of land acquisition, we do an assessment of that property. So that overall assessment kind of covers what the previous uses were for that ground. And then sometimes you get into the cultural resources that are identified in a certain section of land. And since that project fell in those sections and there was multiple locations that the Pawnee Nation requested and essentially kind of required that we do this additional research to make sure that we're not infringing on anything that historical infringement. So.
And one last thing more to the board. I remember, and I was all, I mean, certainly for this, but if we could at some point in time, like an educational part of that area, like have an Earth Lodge sort of similar that there's up there on Blackbird Hill, that perhaps there could be one similar at the Cramper Lake in a spot. And I was always wanting to put that on a further agenda down the road, if at all.
There's a lot of Native American history in that area, a lot.
Oh, so that, I think that would.
Yep. Yeah, no, I agree. That would definitely be, the more information and things you can put out there, it definitely benefits the community.
Director Sapinski?
The USDA, thank you, Director Conley, changes, proposed changes, we don't really have a choice on that.
We're at the mercy of the feds at this one. I mean, they're like I said, they're providing us the grant and the low interest loan. And it's a page and a half. This is what they sent me of the things they want, and it's quite extensive. It really is. There's quite a bit of work that's going to go into this on my end as well as Olson's. Just to give an example, they wanted a number of existing connections broke down into the following categories of residential per user in the townships and sections. That's just one thing. A lot more detailed environmental impacts and land rights and page on page of other things they want. But with the situation we're in, whatever they want, we pretty much have to do, you know. So.
Okay.
I'm hoping that, and I did speak with Matthew Smith, our engineer on this project. He did tell me that he anticipates the $30,000 to be more like $20,000. He thinks it's going to come under budget. And I said, well, that's the first time in history with an engineering firm. So.
Any other questions, Director Jett?
Is there any actual physical work has been done yet, or nothing?
Nothing. No, there's a lot of work that has to be done up front with this before we can even think about beginning construction.
How many hookups do you anticipate when this is completed?
We're anticipating roughly about 50 new additional hookups, but the biggest thing that this is going to provide is quality water to our Cramper Lake, which doesn't even, well, we spent a lot of money and we still have poor water there, but it's also going to provide a connection, a future connection for the village of Hubbard. They're not going to currently hook up to it, but we anticipate down the road they will. And then the biggest thing, too, is we have an antiquated pump house and standpipe in that section. We're going to increase our standpipe from 25,000 gallons to 100,000 gallons. So we're going to quadruple our capacity in the standpipe. We're going to have a reliable pump house that's above ground. Currently, it's in a manhole. It's kind of scary when you go down there, I'll be honest with you. So it's going to create a lot more reliability in the system. We'll actually have backup power generation, which we currently don't have. So it's really going to improve the Dakota County system.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Directors? Roll call.
Stinsky?
Yes.
Yes.
Bonnet?
Yes.
Jeff?
Yes.
And Chairperson?
Hi. Thanks a lot, Jess.
Thank you, Directors.
Item number 8, review and recommendation on District Policy 17.45, private/public dike repair assistance program. John Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Directors. As we know, the historic flood of 2019 caused catastrophic damage throughout the state, not only to public infrastructure, but to private. Currently, most, if not all, of the public infrastructure, especially in the Papu NRD district, has been repaired and brought back to pre-flood condition. However, a significant amount of private infrastructure, specifically levees, that were damaged in the flood have not. There are a few that are currently being repaired by private landowners. Rich has brought this up a number of times, not only to me, but I think to other directors as well. And currently, there's no existing state or federal law or any local ordinance that would require a private levee owner to bring up to fix their damaged levee. The issue with the private levees is they could have been old ag levees built many years ago, or they could have been a sand pit lake that built a levee to protect the property. But the property's probably changed hands many times over. Some folks don't even know that they even own a levee or they're near a levee that does protect their house or the road or whatever infrastructure's there. So these basically have gone either unnoticed or unappreciated. But over the many decades they were there, they did provide a level of flood protection. As development occurred, as counties paved their roads, as little developments built up, these levees did provide a certain level of protection that no one really noticed until they're damaged or gone. So in that vein, we've worked with the Natural Resources Committee, Senator Bossaman. We've attempted to work with various county, as far as Douglas County, and we've attempted to work with the Nebraska Department of Natural Resources, and it appears no one either has the funding or the will or the ability to assist. So we're a little bit kind of on our own. We do know of a couple of spots, and in fact we'll show you some photos after this, that highlights the need to really take care of these. So working with staff and Marlon and Amanda and Rich, we thought somebody's got to do something or this is just going to continue to be a problem. And so we developed this policy to start maybe the process of addressing some of the higher priority ones that we know that are damaged, that we know that need fixed. And so this policy is before you this evening to send to the board for approval. Bill, if you would go to those photos real quick. And Rich, you're the photographer. If you can touch on where these are at and what basically infrastructures are.
This first shot is above Campanelli Road, above Highway 90, or at Campanelli Road, looking west toward Lake Platteview. You can see on the right-hand side the makings of a dike. You can see the white sand. That was completely covered. It washed out right at the very bottom right. You can see the roadway, Campanelli Road. That was about 30 foot deep after the flood of 19. And I approached a number of people to see if we could get some volunteers to donate some gravel, dirt, any type of fill. approached Douglas County, some of those sand pits, and really didn't make any headway with them. Douglas County spent $250,000 for that repair right there. And yet, because that's a private private property, that hole in that dike, they can't do anything about it. I've gone to the state. John's, you know, talked to the legislature. I've talked to them. They're throwing up their hands. They're just not interested in trying to make a commitment to keep up a private dike. If this dike fails, if we get high water again, those mobile homes in the background, they were either gone or washed away in the 19 flood, and there were virtually dozens and dozens of campers, boats, and RVs, jet skis, beyond the picture where I was parked on the road after the flood that they washed through into Venice Woods subdivision. And that's a very nice subdivision right off of Highway 92 on the east bank of the, or about a half mile east of the Platte River. This is the worst of the breaks. Why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, I'll go to the next one.
Okay. During the 19 flood, the there was this washout between two houses. The greenhouse on the right was completely destroyed. The foundation, crawl space, caved in. The whole house collapsed. Obviously, it was built on a lower portion of a sand dike that was built during the construction of Lake Flatview. There was the house after it was going to be demolished. The owner had the windows removed, and the house was later burnt because it was unrepairable. Since that time, the landowner did come back and refill the area along with the owner to the left, and it is in pretty good shape. Go to the next one. If you,
I think that's it, Rich.
Okay. Yep. And there are a couple locations where in between houses there are some low spots where floodwaters came through and caused some damage. I didn't take pictures of them. Some of those have been repaired, others haven't. The major repair, the one that's really got people concerned, is that first picture. It's a massive breach, and it closed Highway 92. It flooded a major subdivision, went down, flooded two rivers, and all the farmlands of, south of Highway 92. If you're familiar with Travis's, there's a Subway sandwich shop out on
264.
And they got it. That whole area just was all underwater due to a breach like this, along with some of the other Platte River waters that came in from Fremont. But guys, I really tried to get the landowners involved, but frankly, they don't have the funding themselves to buy dirt. Dirt is, you know, I'm buying it myself at $200 a load, and it's kind of sandy, though. It's not good topsoil. And so it's, and the sand pits, that were in the area weren't really willing to donate, even though it might save them. So I worked with staff to come up with this program, hopefully to stop flooding and to keep the private dikes up to a certain level, which has to be established. So I would ask your support. I know even Amanda's family, mother and father, lived down in one of those in that subdivision. So they also caught hell. So again, it's an unusual request, but we can't afford to have lives and property put in jeopardy continuously. We were very lucky this year that we didn't have more water. The Fremont Ice Dam kept a lot of that ice and water upstream of us, and so I'm very grateful for that. Unfortunate for those around Fremont, but in any event, that's my pitch.
So if you look at the program, we do have eligible persons and projects, eligible measures, and then the cost sharing and the limitations. So the goal of this program is not to certify levies or to bring them back into some standard. It is basically to bring them back into a pre-flood condition, a pre-2019 flood condition. So basically plug the hole so we don't have any additional flooding that resulted from that breach or that damage. Basically the permitting, the contracting, all of that is on the landowner to do. It's simply the district will be cost sharing. We will not take any long-term operation maintenance. That will again be the landowner that gets the funding to continue to do that operation and maintenance. So this is simply a financial way for them to get that breach or get that damage fixed in any timely manner. And that way we can protect that infrastructure that's out there. The intent is not to throw some money into the budget and hope we get applications. The intent is to budget when we get a eligible application. So whoever comes to us, whatever landowner, group of landowners approach us and say we have, then the staff will research that, make sure it's an eligible project, and then we will budget accordingly for that repair. And again, we're not anticipating this big, massive amount of applications to come in. It'll probably be one, maybe two at a time. There is a limit up to $200,000 for a project. So we're not just going to throw like $1 million or $500,000 into a fund and hope that people come. It will be based on applications we get. So that is the intent. Now, we may only get one or two, and maybe, you know, we won't see any for a while. I'm guessing that heavy rainfall and elevated river conditions will dictate who wants to get things fixed. So, memories are short, so about 15 minutes. So after the flood, people already are moving on to, well, it's never going to flood like that again. And so, but we do have a one or two that we know needs repaired, and the landowners are probably pretty serious about working with us to do that. So that is the intent. I'm happy to answer any other questions you might have or statements you may need to make.
Thanks, John. We can have a motion on this item.
Second.
Okay. Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? Directors? Director Jett?
You say restore them to pre-flood condition.
Yes.
What if they were in really poor condition before the flood? You just restore them to poor condition?
Yeah, we're going to restore them to what we believe would be that pre-flood condition. So again, there's no intent to improve them to any particular standard. It will be to provide the minimum protection that provided at that particular point in time pre-2019.
If some of them have been basically ignored for many, many, many years, yes. They can't be in very good shape to begin with.
They're in various stages of deficiency, yes. But the intent is, like I said, fill the hole, and then to be able to improve them, a levee system significantly, as you know, it's monumentally expensive. And so that is not the intent. We are not here to build new levee systems for people. We're here to say, hey, let's just get this back to where it was.
I guess, does it provide enough help to actually make a difference then if you're going to restore it to a bad condition? Is that worth spending the money on?
It will to those areas that, as Rich pointed out, and that you can see, it will assist. And it will assist not for the large floods. It will assist for what we call the minor to moderate flooding, where people were probably dry for most of the entire time they were there due to minor moderate flooding. But now that there's that damage, they won't be anymore. And so we called it kind of there's a new norm on the plat. There's areas flooding that probably would never flooded before because of this damage, and people might not even know why. But it may be upstream a mile or so, or there's a breach in an old ag levee, and now all of a sudden they're getting water during what seemingly is insignificant events. So this is what we hope to try to avoid those things.
Fields next, and then Larry.
It's not the perfect solution, but right now it's the only solution because there's just nothing else available.
Are you finished, Director Jen?
Yes,
for now. You answered a few of my questions. When I first saw this, I saw $200,000 a piece, and I thought we would have a whole bunch coming out. So you said in your letter a few priority, and I think in your testimony here you said one or two, mm-hmm. you think, per year. Mm-hmm. Where are these areas at? I mean, are they throughout the whole?
So the program limits it to the Elkhorn, Platte, Missouri River, rivers only. But I think the Platte is and those obviously areas Rich pointed out are obviously priority sites because of the county roads, because of the subdivisions. And then other than that, we don't know where the next ones are at.
You just don't think we're going to get 10 of these in a year? Okay.
No, I really and we obviously we can limit that with the ability of the board to say, hey, these are really maybe we address one or two a year. For you know, if there's interest, maybe we have to kind of scale that back and address the highest priority ones, and kind of scale them in.
So we have an opportunity to budget for these.
Yeah, we have an idea. Okay. So just because we get 10 requests doesn't mean you fund them all.
Basically,
I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead, Dennis. The private dike truly began at Blondo Street. And then work down river toward Highway 92. Beyond Highway 92, there really aren't any dikes. But at one time when we did the no-name dike program, which in conjunction with the Union Dike Program, the no-name dike program put a dike behind my house, so my house is susceptible to flooding. The dike is on the my house is on the wet side of the dike. However, at Blondo Street, we were thinking at one time about continuing the no-name project down to Pacific Street. And at that time, Lyman Ritchie, Marlon, I believe it was Lyman Ritchie, owned most of that. And they said we could actually build a better dike than what you folks can. And so they opted not to get involved in the program. I think it is interesting, though, John, it's probably not widely known that at Lake Arrowhead, which is just below Blondo Street, and this is on a private dike, it actually flowed over the dike there for about 45 minutes due to an ice jam. And the same situation basically happened where we're looking down here. Right above Highway 92, there's an island in the middle of the river. There was an ice jam in the that formed right at the top of that island, which backed up water. This area has basically never flooded to, in my experience, until 2019. In my mind, I'm convinced it was due to an ice jam.
Director Bradley and then Director Bailey.
Well, just to mention, as I've taught environmental geology, during the 93 flood, I think for the Missouri River, it was 92-93, there was private dikes or levees that were built in the 1700s down in New Orleans that held better than the modern ones. I mean, they held test of time. And modern ones did give way. But for this, how would you say some of these private ones are 50, 60 years old?
This one was probably built in the 30s. And it was basically just they dug a sand pit, and this is just the outcroppings of the sand pit, and then they made it into a dike.
But we might not be hearing any squawking now, but have a good flood year, and we'll have something in place to maybe answer those folks. So.
Director Bailey.
Rich, Director Teaser, if I heard you right, the state threw their hands up. Does that mean there's no grants or anything? Is that because it's private and the state doesn't want to touch it?
The legislature is not enthusiastic about getting into the funding private dikes.
We talked about that after 19, I remember, and that when you said they threw their hands up, I'm assuming that's the same thing they've done consistently since 19 and before.
And I, I worked diligently for 2 years now trying to get somebody to make that repair. and the landowner supposedly is in a financial hurts that he can't even remotely fund such a project.
And Danny, to give you an idea on the timing of the legislature, so there was a part of Senator Bossman's bill last year was to do a kind of a inventory of these, of levies, public and private, and that's not even completed yet.
Yeah.
And so to rely on the state or the legislature, you're looking at multiple years before you would even begin to start the formulation of a program or project, and then to get the funding, it would be probably three or four years.
When that came up, John, when they were going to do that study, you probably, I'm not speaking for you, but did you assume that it was going to take multiple years to even scratch the surface of that reality?
We always do. I mean, just because we work within the system and we know it's nothing they can do fast. Obviously, local jurisdictions can respond faster. And part of this, part of the program or the policy will be that landowner will have to reach out to NRCS, FEMA, those agencies and say, hey, is there any assistance? So they're going to have to exhaust those resources or get told, no, you're on your own, and then we come in. So it's not like we're abandoning those. They'll have to go through that communication to see if there is money available. Most likely no, but at least we're making them reach out and see if there is. So right. We're trying to get as much resource as we can, but there isn't anything available.
Understood. Thanks.
Director Japp?
Well, I'm just looking at the big picture. From all the way from Blair to South Sioux City along the Missouri River, there's lowlands. A lot of those farmers have built their own little dikes. There's, you know, drainage districts, Washington County Drainage District, mm-hmm. but they build levees and dikes. A lot of those were damaged and so forth. So I guess, you know, I understand we're kind of concentrating on that little spot, but there's a lot of levees and dikes all the way up and down the Missouri River and up in Dakota County and those lowlands, everything. They're everywhere.
It's part of the eligible. We try to anticipate that. So it's part of the eligibility. You can't just simply be protecting. It has to be protecting infrastructure, roads, bridges, something.
Does that include a private road, or does that be a public road?
A public road. Most of them are public roads, public bridges. And things like that. So we wouldn't be out protecting, you know, 40 acres of open field, at least at this point. Maybe we get in that in the future. But we're really the idea is to protect those assets that are public in nature.
You have questions?
Just curious, how did you arrive at the 10%? And is that solely the property owner or anyone that's influenced by the levy?
So it'd be 90% district, 10% landowners. I think we put it at that at that high level, one, to just encourage that these get repaired. One is to put the carrot out there because there's no stick, basically. There's no regulation. And then also, just because of success with other programs, you know, we've been at the 50%, we've been at the 60%, and It just seems like those, you know, get very little interest. So we thought we would put it up a little, and that's open, but we thought we'd put it up a little higher because it is a priority that we get these taken care of. And so we wanted that cost share to be high enough where somebody could realistically come in and be able to participate. Now, if we said 50-50, probably no one because you got a $200,000 repair, $100,000, you know, good luck. They might not have $5,000 to do it. So that's why we put the 10% cost share in there, just to see what.
And you anticipate that'll be paid by the sole landowner?
Landowner or landowners, depending how many
people. The guy downstream, we probably want to.
And maybe that breach or that damage may go across a couple different landowners.
Right.
So, you know, if they can get more, probably, you know, if they can share the cost, the better for them and us. So.
That's all I have.
Any other questions? Roll call.
Yes.
Bobbitt?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Dubinsky?
Yes.
And
Chairperson. Aye. Thanks, John. I think you're up on the next one.
I am.
Item number 9, review and recommendation of cost share agreement with Sarpy County Sheriff's Office for purchase of airboat. John Winkler, Lieutenant Dennis Sabota?
Sabota.
And Sheriff Jeff Davis, Sarpy County Sheriff's Office.
And also with them is our very own Deputy Ben Leonards, if we need any questions from him.
Okay.
So, So Kevin Sapinski and I met with the sheriff and his staff for a number of months ago. It was last year, I believe. But they experienced kind of the same thing we heard from other law enforcement, other first responding agencies, that the pandemic, not only the floods of 19, but also the pandemic of 20, river usage has just exploded. And again, most of those are probably folks that have never been on a body of water, a lake or a river in their lives. And so there's been a lot of instances that they've experienced, and they can tell you firsthand, I'll let them talk, of rescues that they needed to accomplish. I know the incident of the young lady that was, or young girl that was lost in the Platte River, and they still have not, I believe, recovered her. They're in a search mode at one time and search and rescue mode, and then it ended up in a recovery mode, unfortunately. But the sheriff's office was just woefully inadequate with the equipment they had for the river. They have, I think it's an old Go Devil. And if you've seen those work, they're very slow and awkward to maneuver in the Platte River. So I'll let the sheriff and the deputy talk about the need they have. But again, this is not the first time we've heard this. We've assisted other agencies. But I believe that even post-pandemic now, what we've seen on the Elkhorn, on the Platte, on the Missouri, is there's just more and more use. And I know they even rely on a lot of private citizens to assist with their airboats. Now, obviously, private citizens aren't on 911, so if they're not there, then these guys have to go with what they have. So, but I will turn it over to them and let them kind of talk to you about what they need and the issues that they face.
Sure.
Good afternoon, Jeff Davis, Sarpy County Sheriff. As John said, the floods occurred in 2019. I'm sure you're aware of that. And then we had several incidents that occurred last year. We currently cover 43 miles of shallow basin, if you will, river, which is the Platte River, 37 miles and 6 miles of the Elkhorn River. And I'm not including the Missouri River in that. And the primary means of travel on those rivers are airboats, and you've probably all seen them out there. There's more airboats than most other watercraft. Our current shallow water boat is a 25-year-old Gold Devil. It has limited capabilities, as you might expect. In 2019, an airboat would have assisted us in the number of rescues that we had at Kristen Hansen's Lake, Reha Lakes, Lenoma, Camp Gifford, La Platte, and Paradise Lakes. A few of those missions, we asked for assistance with the public, with their airboats, and in one case, the Game and Parks airboat. Some of the events that occurred in 2020, you may or may not be aware, we assisted in pulling out a state of Nebraska snowplow that was actually partially, if not mostly, submerged in the river. We rescued a 73-year-old gentleman who almost drowned and was caught up in a tree there. For that, we used our inflatable boat with a six horsepower motor. It worked, but we were limited as to what we could do with that. On June 6th, there were two separate call-outs, a canoe overturned. Thankfully, the three people in that canoe made it to safety. But shortly thereafter, there was a female that was caught in a brush pile. Those both were call-outs for our Marine Rescue Team. And then, as John spoke, on June 11th of last year, we had an 8-year-old girl that went missing, still hasn't been found. That resulted in 37 different rescue missions and over 700 hours on the river. And as he also mentioned, this past summer we've seen, and I think you know, that there is a substantial increase in public recreation on the Elkhorn as well as the Platte, and includes a number of private outfitters that are conducting various tubing and other boating adventures. Dennis, do you want to add anything to that?
No.
This is Lieutenant Dennis Sobota, who's in charge of our Marine response team.
Good afternoon. What I'd like to add is the sheriff talked about a lot of things that we do on the water. I'd like to talk about a couple things that we do off the water with our boats. You know, we cost-shared a boat with the NRD back in 2013. We use that boat all the time for displays purposes. Before COVID hit in 2019, we took part in 8 different parades throughout the county. And that boat's displaying NRD decals on it. We also take part in numerous static displays, like at fire stations, schools, neighborhood events. So we're out there quite a bit. Even though the boat's not on the water, we're also out there when it's out of the water. So basically every weekend during the summer, our boat's doing something. So unless somebody has a question for me, that's all I'd like to add.
Where do you store the boat?
Currently, we have our boats at our garage down at the sheriff's office. With the airboat, we do the same thing during the winter months. Ultimately, during the summer, we'd like to store it as close to the river as we can. We'll look into maybe some different properties to where we can have it on shore and ready to go in case there's a water rescue.
I have a question, if I could. It seems to me that under Sheriff Thomas, 25 to 30 years ago, we cost-shared on an airboat at that time.
You know, I've been here 47 years, which is a long time. But I think that was over 30 years ago that that happened. At that point, I wouldn't be speaking from knowledge if I told you we did cost-share that. I remember we had an airboat. It was kind of a pleasure airboat. I know we didn't get it new. And it wasn't... It wasn't the safest thing on the river, let me put it that way. It wasn't built for rescues. This would be a totally different situation with this airboat. So, and you may be correct. I don't recall that myself, but that's a possibility.
Thank you very much. Anyone? We could have a motion on this item.
Motion to go with staff recommendation.
Second.
Anyone from the public wish to speak to the item? John, did you want to
I just want to make sure, Sheriff. I live on the river, and I sometimes put hoop nets on the river to catch pound and sturgeon. I keep them above Highway 92. Now you won't come up that far. Right?
I have never been up that way in my entire life.
Okay, you're good. You got my vote.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Yes, sir.
Rick, John, is this for this fiscal year?
So we try to find in the budget for this, and I think what we'll do, we'll have to budget it into the next, and then reimburse them as early as we can with the next fiscal year budget. We didn't have anything that we could basically take it from to reallocate it. So I think we'll just put it into the regular budget for the next year.
Assuming it gets approved on Thursday.
Assuming it gets approved on Thursday.
It's going to be bought, and then we'll
reimburse the okay.
It'll be acquired for this season.
Yes. Yeah, I believe so. When do you take possession?
Yes, that's
correct. I mean, sooner the better, in my opinion.
Sooner the better. You're correct, and we're hitting that season already. And I think Lieutenant Sabota informed me that they'll have it running later this week. Not water worthy yet, so they're working on it as we speak. We are going to, our part of it is going to come from drug dealers, if you will, from federal forfeiture funds as much as we can. So, but we do really rely on your assistance in some of these cases, and these is one of those. So we appreciate that.
Thank you. Director Brady.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was wondering about when you said drug dealers, we can't pretend that there isn't drug deals that go down on the river. And would this craft be part of that operations? You know?
It's certainly, no pun intended, because we're talking about the river on the rise. And we saw a lot of that happening on some of those sandbars. We tried to address it with support teams, not just our Marine Rescue, but we actually sent a team of people from our office, the state troopers, and the Game and Parks, on several of those occasions. We did make several of arrests for people that at least were possessing narcotics or were throwing them in the river as we were going out there. It was a little tough to hit them. But we had a situation where we had all the airboats, not ours because we didn't have one, but some of the public's, State Patrol, I think, was out there. And we went up to one of those fairly quickly, and that's one where we were able to recover. Made some arrests, but recovered quite a bit that was just thrown out there. So that does exist. It is out there, and I'm sure it's not going to it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Thank you.
Sir, what's your experience with procuring government surplus?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any what's your experience in procuring
government surplus boats or other equipment from the GSA? You know,
we secured a Humvee from the government probably about 10 years ago, and it's been very successful for us. We secured an MRAP, which is almost finished for our SWAT team. We look at all that merchandise. They tell me that if you go down to Florida, and for whatever reason, we don't have access to that, but they have planes, boats, search vehicles, but we really haven't been able to acquire any of that. Most of our surplus is government surplus, and I don't think I've ever seen an airboat out there. So,
okay. The GSA has a number of Panthers available, $8,700 a piece.
We take a look at them, that's for sure. So,
okay. This boat is specifically designed and built for water rescue? Are we precluded from participating in GSA auctions?
I think we can look at it, but I don't ever remember seeing an airboat on.
And that might be a great idea. What I will tell you, both with the Hummer and the MRAP, and don't get me wrong, the MRAP's probably worth $750,000 or a little less than that, but we're going to have, we got it for very little money, but we're going to have to put probably $100,000+ into it to get it roadworthy. And the same thing for the Hummer. We've got quite a bit of money invested in it. It's worth more than that, believe me. But
any additional questions?
Roll call.
Bonnet?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
Lindsay?
Yes.
Teaser?
Yes.
And Jefferson?
Aye. And that's, we adjourn.
Well, the time is 5:01. We'll call the FEL subcommittee to order. With that, roll call.
Hensley?
Here.
Grassley?
Here.
Davidson?
Here.
McCormick?
Here.
Jefferson?
Here. Notification of the Open Meeting Act posted in the back of the room. Outside is the posting. Quorum call, I guess we already have. Adoption of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Who was the second?
Begley.
Who was the motion the second?
Begley.
And McCormick was the motion. Thank you. Okay, Bradley?
Yes.
Davidson?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Begley?
Aye.
Chairperson?
Yes. Item 6, review of information of Lee Bridge Highway 31 Connecting Link Relocation Project Property Transfer Agreement with NUTCO Inc. Will we need to go into exec session?
Yeah,
okay.
I recommend.
Make a, can we get a motion to go into exec session, please?
So moved. I'll second.
And who seconded?
I'll second.
Okay. Roll call.
Davidson?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Begley?
Aye.
Bradley?
Yes.
Jefferson?
Yes.
Turn the sound on, too.
Come out?
Yeah.
I'll go out of executive session.
Second.
McCormick?
Yes.
Begley?
Aye.
Bradley?
Yes.
Davidson?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I'm assuming nobody's outside. We'll not go for the door. So let's, can we get a motion on item number 6, please?
So move.
Second.
Any further discussion?
Yes. A few weeks ago, in order to both inspect the trail location and the lead bridge, we used our drone to do an ice jam inspection in this location. So we have a few photos to kind of show the area and kind of the overlapping interests that we have in both stormwater management and recreation in this location. So this is a view looking up the Platte River. You can see the west side over here in Cass County. The east side, here is where the trail was from Highway 31 right there, running down along the banks, and then it would connect right here to the end of the trail. Looking upstream, there was quite a bit of ice right on the upstream side of the lead bridge, but there was an open channel for a couple hundred feet on the west side. So this is why I was out here to inspect to make sure that there was plenty of channel flow, that we weren't at any risk of ice jam flooding here. And this, Bill, if you want to go ahead and press play.
You want the video?
Yeah. So like I said, the drone is able to do an inspection of the entire lead bridge. You can see on the left is upstream. Those are the icebreaker noses, which we just repaired. We're coming up to a few that have some steel straps to help hold them in place from the flood damage. The lighter one right there has new steel straps to help stabilize it from damage in 2019. This one was entirely repaired and is a different, shorter structure. And then these next two were also reinforced. So we were able to both look at the trail, look at the ice in the river, and look at the structure in ways that we hadn't previously been able to. So this new drone inspection capability is very beneficial for all of the work we've done in this location. You can see there was some ice downstream from the bridge. Turning back to look west and back toward Cass County now. Primarily, you can see the ice is on the upstream side of the bridge, and we could get in nice and close and see. There you go. That's a good example of pieces of ice piled up on the structure itself. This is specifically the purpose of the icebreaker, is to avoid those large chunks hitting the structure and causing damage. That is what occurred in 2019 when the water was about 10 feet higher in this location and the ice was significantly thicker. So this shows all of the repair work that was done, the debris removal from the foot or the bottom part of the piers. The railing along the upstream side of the bridge was removed and reinstalled for a few hundred feet. And then the icebreaker noses were either reinforced or one was entirely reconstructed on site. Those three projects have already been reconstructed. Here again, you can see the open channel section on the very far west section. Here is the ice through the middle of the river, and it'll turn all the way around and look back across the structure. So this new equipment that we purchased 2 years ago was extremely helpful for a couple different projects simultaneously. We've also used it on the Elkhorn IPA for inspections, and I expect to use it again this coming year. So this kind of gives a flavor of what we can do in ways that would not previously have been possible. And this is, after the purchase of the equipment, there is no cost to do this. I was able to make it down there and back and do all of the documentation in about an hour and a half. If you can go back to the photos and just skip to the next one. So, yeah, here again I was able to look, and we could zoom in quite a bit closer and see the structural pieces that we had corrected. There's the pileup of the ice. And you can see these steel straps that we repaired on this nose had tipped just a few degrees, and so new steel was installed to hold it to the pier itself. Here again is the ice piled up on that nose. This one looks a lot shorter. It looks basically vertical. This is a new, more modern icebreaker nose design that we used instead of the roughly 45 degrees. This is a 12-to-1 slope on the front here. So it serves the same function per our structural design on the repair project, but was a little easier to do the installation without getting down into the water. There again is the ice on the upstream side. And the drone can get up to about 400 feet, so we're looking downstream. There's a little bit of ice downstream here as we look down south and east on the Platte. Then again, here's the open section of the channel. So we were able to verify that there was plenty of room. There was not a significant risk of ice jam flooding at this location at this time. And this is something you couldn't really see from the ground. You can't see from either bank, but very easy to see from 400 feet with the drone in the air. And you can also get great pictures of the structure itself, which we can use for promotional material in the future. So that allowed us to both inspect the work that was already completed and simultaneously do some ice jam inspection. So that provides an update on all of the work that has been done at the lead bridge to date. We have the construction contract for the trail out now. The contract specifies the completion by July 2nd, so it would be open for the holiday weekend. We expect to have that contract, a recommendation on that contract, at the board meeting next month. And at this time, we just need to finalize the property rights with NEBCO in order to allow this all to be completed.
Any other questions? Seeing none, let's go to... Go ahead.
Aye.
Bradley?
Yes.
Davidson?
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Chairperson?
Yes. Thank you. Item 9, review the recommendation of caution... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm on the wrong... Item 7, review the recommendation of district legal expenses. John Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, directors. Currently, the district has an agreement with Hush Blackwell for legal services, and that was set to expire on June 30th, 2020. However, the Board of Directors extended it for 1 year to June 30th of 2021 in order for us to conduct an independent cost-benefit analysis of hiring an in-house legal counsel. That was presented to the board last month. Upon completion of the in-house legal counsel, management went into kind of an in-depth operational evaluation. We did conduct a survey of district staff. I wanted to get some direct input from them. And as you can see on the back of the memo, these are just a few of the comments that I received from staff. I did allow them to provide that input anonymously because I didn't want to have any indication that they were being influenced, and no one chose that opportunity. They all provided it willingly via email or by direct conversation with me. There was a couple items to note that I didn't include in the attachment. One is that Brent does our engineering ethics training class. He does that every year, and it's a requirement of our engineers for their continuing education and their continuing to maintain their professional engineering license. And not only does he do that for us, there is no charge to us for that, but he also does it for other outside entities as well. And then also, Hush Blackwell has a special levee safety department, and I have forgot to mention these guys in the past. So it's Corinne Jacoby from Kansas City, and they have a separate levee safety that deals with levees throughout the entire country, but mostly Missouri, Louisiana, kind of Mississippi, Missouri related issues. I've consulted with her numerous times. She's consulted with me and Marlon on numerous, especially with Corps of Engineers requirements, a 408 permitting, funding, all of those types of things. And we have yet to receive a bill from her for that. And so we rely on them quite a bit. And I always forget because they're in Kansas City, but since we do have the relationship here with Hush Blackwell, then we are able to avail ourselves of her expertise and all of her connections with those folks. In fact, we were encouraged to attend with many levee districts throughout the South a 408 coalition that went to Washington, D.C. and spoke with individual members of Congress on the 408 permitting process, which we all know too well is broken. So, but we rely on those quite a bit. So after that analysis and talking with staff, so basically no performance, no budgetary or operational issues or deficiencies exist with our current legal counsel. So the only recommendation that I can make from an operational perspective of the district is to renew that agreement. If there's any other issue, if it's performance or operation or any other problem, I am not aware of it, and I have not been made aware of it. So the recommendation before you is to extend their agreement for another 3 years reaffirm them or to reappoint them as the district legal counsel. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. If we want to get into the specifics of the agreement or the contract that they're proposing, I would recommend we go into executive session. We don't want to get into a situation we had last time where they presented information that was proprietary, especially with fees, and then that change where we didn't renew that agreement. So, but any other questions we could handle in open session.
Any discussion? Any questions?
And obviously, Brent's here to answer any questions.
Nobody? All right. Can we get a motion on the floor?
I motion to accept staff recommendation.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. Discussion? Larry first.
Yes, I'd like to make an alternative motion. We put legal services out for RFP.
Larry, could just have...
I didn't hear you either.
A substitute motion that we perhaps put legal services contract out for RFP.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a substitute motion. Any further discussion? Mr. Thompson.
In addition to the staff identification, the people that actually use this service that you see in front of you on the memo, as chairman of this board, I am probably more involved with more conversations than a lot of folks on this board. I've never once had any issue with Hush Blackwell. it's only been positive. And I want to reinforce the staffs who actually do the work that Hush Blackwell is most definitely the law firm of choice from my perspective as chairman. For an RFP, I want you to understand what that substantive motion entails. And if you don't understand, I'll certainly reiterate. But for discussion purposes, I guess I'll, unless you want to explain that or want me to explain it with your substantive motion, what it would in fact do.
Please, Karen, if I'm not the chair.
Okay. If you're suggesting RFP, the chairman appoints an ad hoc committee. The ad hoc committee goes out for requests for proposals. We don't talk about money. I know Patrick Bennett, when I talked to him, he used the word bid. Please do not even put that in your vocabulary. We don't talk about bids for this. So your request for an RFP and your second says, we want to get a better firm. I'm totally against that because of the nature of this firm and how they've supported this district. So an RFP is an ad hoc committee is appointed by the chairman, which wouldn't be until April. I decide who's on the RFP committee. The RFP committee, if that's approved, we go out and gather the potential firms. We rate who's the best, and then we present the best to the board. And when the board receives the best, we vote on it. Think down the line what that process incurs. And I would have to question the motive behind an RFP before I would have you guys vote on it in subcommittee. What are you after in a request for proposal to get other firms?
If I may.
You may.
I guess addressing a couple of your points. One, in my view, it doesn't have anything to do with the work that Hush Blackwell does. I wasn't on this board 7 years ago in 2014 when they were selected. I think they do great work. In my view, it's a simple fact of I would like in any public body, I don't care if it's the NRD or a host of others, I think it's incumbent upon the boards to go through their process of an ad hoc committee as you select and you appoint the directors.
That's the rule.
If I can finish, understood. You appoint that, and then there's five directors, as we went through on the Beltline Trail. I changed my mind a little bit through that just because of listening to the other directors and the presentations. Again, if I can say for the tenth time, I think you're characterizing this, at least I don't want you to say that my words are that they're not doing a great job because I think they do a fine job. I just want to go through the process to understand the whole picture of how you select that because I wasn't here in 14. That's why I voted to second that. It wasn't on performance. It's on I would like to spend, even if I'm not picked for the ad hoc committee by the chair, I would certainly sit in because it's an education process for me. So that's my comments.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, since I made the motion and it's not a motive.
I can't hear you either.
Since I made the motion, it's not saying that I have a motive behind this. Okay, it's a line of thinking, and part of it is a transparency and for being stewards of the taxpayers. Being stewards of the taxpayers and there was a Silverstone did a study, and I'm understanding that is probably public record, so I don't want to say anything to jeopardize if we should go into executive session. So not, but what was public record and what was put out for amount, you just want to say that perhaps we can also entertain and look at other firms. And as you know, as you would be appointing an ad hoc committee, if after through the presentations, Hush Blackwell would be at the top, then let it move forward. But I think for transparency and also for being stewards for the taxpayers. I really, you know, would rather have put this out for RFP.
So when you say, I'm sorry. I got a call. So when you say stewards of the taxpayers, do you say, understand what Mr. Thompson is saying as correct, where we cannot go into a bid, basically? Is he correct when he's saying that this is just basically an RFP for request for qualifications, request for proposal? We're not really getting a different bid or a different price. Is that correct? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, you would go out for an RF, basically an RFQ, request for qualifications, which professional services are selected on in the state of Nebraska. So you would not talk about – so you would interview firms, and you would – what the committee thought would be the best firm,
and then
take that to the board. If the board approved that we either go with Hush Blackwell or another firm, then you start talking about fees. And so you're actually – the negotiation of fees aren't even until the firm's selected.
Okay.
And then we start that conversation. And then we bring a contract back to the full board for approval.
So with that in mind, in my opinion, as a newbie, I don't even understand why we would even go out for an RFP if staff and everybody else is happy with what we're doing, unless there's something I'm totally missing. You know, why would we go through that? I understand, you know, I've had some discussions about the cost. I thought that was going to be a big issue of this. It seems to me like that's not a big issue in this. So I guess my question is, as a new guy, why would we be going out for an RFQ if we're happy with the services? Obviously, staff is happy with the services, so just educate me why we would be doing this if cost isn't the issue. And I understand cost. I understand the stewards part about that. I get that. But it doesn't sound to me like that's in play here. It seems like there's other factors, if that's fair.
Patrick?
So when I approach decisions like this, I'm kind of a process guy, and I've got my own metrics for voting on one firm or another, whether it be law firm or engineering firm or project. So I always like to understand what metrics we use, not just to select a firm, but to manage the subcontractors that are working for us. I want to know if we hand off a job to a firm, how quickly it gets done, and at what cost. Cost is always on my mind because we do need to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars, and it does absolutely need to be transparent, in my opinion. So I'm not afraid of an RFP, and I know Hush Blackwell is not afraid of an RFP because they perform well. But what happens in this process if you select a firm and then you can't negotiate a price that we're all willing to accept?
Then you would go to the next firm.
Then you would next firm down, next so firm. We'd have to rank them. And so you'd have to go through that RFP process anyways.
Well,
not true?
Or you would just, you don't go through it again, you would just go to the next most qualified firm.
But how do you know who that is?
That's why we rank them.
That's why you rank them in the...
We say one and two in subcommittee.
Yeah, in the ad hoc committee, you would rank... Say there's three firms or two firms, you'd rank...
You'd have to go to RFP to have that ad hoc committee in order to rank them. Isn't that true?
Yes. But you would rank them as part of the RFQ process. So if you went to the RFQ, you would rank them. If you could not come up with an agreement with the number one firm that the ad hoc wanted or the board wanted, then you would go to the next firm. And
so if we were to simply just to renew a contract, then we're still going to want to have a conversation about fees and prices and whatever other metrics you might have.
Yeah. So every metrics that I evaluate or that my staff evaluates, I mean, they pass. I mean, they perform. I don't have any other metrics. We work with other entities that have – work with other firms, and quite frankly, I don't know where you're going to find the cost savings. We looked at the in-house counsel, and you looked at one person, and there's just no physical or feasible way that person would be able to handle all this work without bringing in additional resources. So just from a pure management operational standpoint, they have not missed any matrix of evaluation. And that's why I went to my staff who work with them probably more than I do, and said, what do you guys think? My comments aren't even in the evaluation. I didn't even comment because I read all the comments that I got from every staff that has their matrix that they work with, and there was nothing in there that I could add. So I don't know what matrix I could hang my hat on that they have not accomplished or met from a purely operational standpoint of the NRD.
So that says really two things. Either the work we're presenting is not that difficult, and any firm that's a reasonable skill could achieve that reasonable result, or we just don't know, because we haven't asked the market what the price would be on the completion of that work. And you only ask the market through RFP. I think that's what you're getting at, and I'm just trying to understand the process.
You know, I've been here on this board since first 1984, and I kind of lived through a legal representation for a number of years, and I have to tell you, I was so impressed when we got Hutch Blackwell. And one thing I think you folks are failing to remember, there is a tremendous learning curve. If we hire a new firm, they don't know squally shit, excuse my French, about No Name Dyke or this creek or this project over here or that project over there. And we have a firm that has been doing an admirable job. Everybody seems to be happy with them. They've achieved the learning curve. They're telling us, giving us good advice. Why would you want to change? I just don't understand.
Well, I guarantee our workload is like no other agency in the state, guaranteed. We're a multi-regional entity that deals with countless other political jurisdictions on a whole range of issues that no one else in the state deals with. And so our level of work is, and you can talk to the auditors, bring it up every year. There is no other entity that they audit that is as complex and as difficult to operate and maintain and manage than this one. And so that's what you're dealing with. Now, is there other firms that could do the work? There probably is. But as Rich said, there's a learning curve. Our prior attorney was with us for how long, Marlon? Paul Peters.
35 years,
and he couldn't handle the work. And he knew us inside and out. And I constantly had staff, where's this agreement? Where's this contract? Where? And it was a literal operational nightmare. And that's why I think when Hutch Blackwell came on board, that's when everything, I have not heard one comment in 6 years that nothing was handed in on time. And you can bring up every one of my staff members and ask them the same question, if I'm in the room or not. And they'll tell you the exact same thing. So purely from the operation of the district, that is my recommendation. Now, if you want to do what you, that's fine. We will work with whatever we have to do. But I'm simply stating there's nothing wrong.
Judge Thompson.
That's a matrix question, if you're wondering. The study by Silverstone gave us a matrix, if you look at it. There's at least 12 items that we would want in a firm, just like we want in an employee. So that's a start. That's not all inclusive. But keep in mind, and you use the stewards of the tax dollar. In this case, it doesn't really apply, because you can get different. We're not going to talk about price because we're in open session. But you can get different. Oh, look, they're X an hour. They're X minus, you know, $50 an hour, whatever. Oh, well, that's cheaper. Get that out of your mind. It doesn't even come close to what we're contracting for here. There's a startup program. If we were to switch in midstream, so that's not midstream, excuse the pun. There is a startup cost in that. This is really a requirements type contract. And the contracting word says world. We say we order that we contract for these terms, conditions, and we, in essence, order parts of that contract, in other words, based on hourly rate or job. If a new firm comes in that you think might be better, well, I'm sorry, you're not doing the work. Every staff member here is. We sit here and nod our head. that's the, those are the people that we depend on. They've done a fantastic job. If we're going to steer them to someone else to do our legal services, we're not doing our job properly. We really aren't. Fraser Stryker, OPPD, how many times have they switched firms for Fraser Stryker? I don't need an answer. I'm throwing that out rhetorically because you're with another government agency. You might want to ask that when you return to work. But it's a requirements contract. We're going to order services. There is a startup. There is a not only that, but during if we were to transition, House Blackwell just can't say, here are the folders. There would be a cost involved, a duplicate cost involved with a transition from one firm to another. So you're talking about taxpayer dollars. That's going to, the chart's going to go like this, and then who knows if it'll level out to where we've been. I don't think it'll be with their expertise. John mentioned the Kansas City office, which if we think about a year ago, to me that was a major thing when that individual was working with the Corps in their favor when we talked about this last May. Wonderful asset to have with a firm like Hush Blackwell. So it's okay to think about costs and all that, but this is a this is the ultimate professional. I shouldn't say ultimate necessarily because we got architect engineers who design dams. It's in that same category. You can't really define it. You got a feeling, you got a gut feeling. And we have a gut feeling because we don't know better. We don't see the actual, we see the result of the actual work that they do, the staff does. And you're going to tell me that every staff member who responded positively, I don't believe them. That's what you're telling me when I'm trying to search. And I got to believe him. I nod my head because, hey, Eric Williams did a great job on the trail thing. He answered my question. I got full confidence. And that's what I've installed, hopefully, in the minds of confidence that we have in staff. I've mentioned that before during chairman's report in the past. So this is really no different. We're saying, staff, continue. You're doing great. You're keeping us out of trouble. And with the law firm itself that we now have. I'll talk more if you want, Mr. Chair, but I'll continue. Let you continue.
You did fine, thank you. Yeah. Any other comments?
I'd just like to express a feeling I have now that the election is recent.
Could you speak rejoining
the board,
to the microphone?
This is the first contract that I'm going to be voting on here, and this happened. It gives me kind of a chance to remember back not too long ago when engineering firms came in, and when we put out a project for an RFP, we'd get one person to respond or one firm, maybe two firms, and we'd have to go back to the table and send out a second RFP or rebid, request for an RFP because we didn't have enough. And so I know it's not, it's a little bit apples and oranges, but it's a precedent. I don't like to rubber stamp anything, and this is how it could be perceived. I want an explanation, and I'll come up with my own explanation, but it makes me nervous renewing a contract after it's already been renewed and not going out to the public or the marketplace for a contract, because engineering firms can say the same thing, which they have in the past. It's always HDR or it's JEO, and so we ended up with three main. We actually have to go out to the public and ask for more firms and let them know that it's not a rubber stamp here. We would appreciate additional bids. Bring to the table whatever you can present. So in the end, I'd just like to hear from the marketplace.
One last, if I may. Mr. Chair, as I said, sorry. Okay. Yeah, as I said last year, I'll be brief. My belief is to put it out, and once we go through that, as I said a year ago, and as I've said since then, once I'm satisfied, Hush Blackwell's got a great advantage. They've done the work, as Chairman Thompson has said, they've done well. I just want to go through that and have my own conclusion. And once we do that, if Hush Blackwell's at the top, which I think they're a three-touchdown favorite because they've done a great job, I'll be the first one to say that as a director. So thanks.
Thank you. Any further comments? Seeing none, roll call.
On the substitute motion.
On the substitute motion.
Okay. What was this motion for our...
Correct.
Bradley?
Yeah.
Danielson?
No.
McCormick?
No.
Bentley?
Yes.
Jefferson?
No.
3-0,
2-0. Okay, you're back to the...
Motion again.
You don't have to. I get a second.
Yep.
Did he get a second, correct?
Yes, okay. Yeah,
okay. No, Director McCormick on his original motion.
Oh, his original motion?
I did.
Davidson did. Okay, so you just have to do roll call.
We get discussion on the second motion? I mean, on the original?
On the original motion?
Yes, sir.
Director Bradley.
I just... sorry about that. I want to say that I appreciate staff and I appreciate the board and the committee chair and everything this time around, sort of, I guess, as I want to say, doing it proper, giving us time to weigh in on this and discuss issues and possibilities. I know where the cards are, for Thursday night, so I understand that, so this probably, it's probably, but I just want to say I appreciate the candor and more the transparency and openness coming this time, a year later, as we're looking at renewing a contract for legal counsel.
Thank you very much for those comments. Seeing no other comments, we'll call a question.
Yes.
McCormick?
Yes.
Bentley?
This is the call to question.
No, this is the question.
The original motion?
The original motion.
I'm sorry, the original motion was 3 years.
Yeah, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, could you clarify the motion? Could
please.
You did say I did
misspeak. We are now voting on the original motion, which is...
Staff recommendation.
Staff recommendation.
Thank you. No.
Bradley?
No.
Jefferson?
Yes. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, the time is 5:47. We have concluded our work. We stand adjourned.